beach easy.
And I remember being in the hospital, and because my other friends would come in, but I hadn't seen Robert. And I remember asking my mom or my dad to, hey, can you call Robert and see if he can come up here and bring his laptop? And I think probably I'd asked several times, and I forget what role this one therapist played. And he was the one who said, Caleb, Robert is not going to come see you. He said he died in your car accident. And it just, even now, I mean, thinking about that moment, is just, nothing's ever surprised me so much in my life. I felt so bad.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. I'm Julie, and today I'm with Caleb Weigel. He's an author who's really gaining a lot of popularity for his Myrtle Beach series of mystery novels that are set right here in the Grand Strand. He's had a tremendous journey getting to where he is now, and it all started in a small town in West Virginia where he grew up.
There was no town. It was a very small farming, coal mining community. There was about 550 people who lived there, spread across several miles. We had a post office and a general store that had a gas pump. That was all we had. Eventually, we got a fire department, and that was it.
Yeah.
Somebody had a shed out beside their house where they rented VHS and video games.
Yeah.
That was the extent of our town. Our closest town was Summersville, and it was about 20 minutes away or so. But if it had a bad snow during the winter, you couldn't get there.
That sounds crazy.
Yeah.
And
everybody knew everybody there,
yeah,
too, because you drive, there's a one-lane road, both sides of Mount Lookout, and you drive down, somebody passed you, you always knew who it was, you always wave. Sometimes people, you talk, stop and just talk to them.
Yeah.
They're in the middle of the road, just everybody knew everybody. It's like Cheers. You know, growing up in a small town, you know, it helped me grow up and appreciate nature a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had, you know, big dense woods behind our house, and we go for walks through the woods often, and explore. And we had our trails and places we would go, and we knew where we could, like, walk through the woods and come out the other side on a different road and circle back around to our house. And we played a lot of sports. There weren't cookie cutter neighborhoods like there are here, where people actually had big yards, big front yards, backyards. And we'd play a lot of football, a lot of baseball in people's yards. Of course, we lived in West Virginia with the mountains and the hills. In the wintertime, we did a lot of sleigh riding. That's one of the few things I do miss about West Virginia, is having that occasional big snow where you can get out and just build a snowman, throw snowballs, and just go sleigh riding. Spent a lot of time outside. We had a pool behind our house, and we could also go down to the lakes and rivers and go swimming. We just had a real pleasant childhood.
Caleb had a core group of friends. Growing up in such a small community allowed them to become deeply close, spending most days together playing, exploring, and experiencing life. Then, tragedy struck.
Whenever I was in high school, I had several close friends. There were three close friends. It was Robert, Sonny, Jack, and Grant. And there was one day shortly after I graduated that Robert and I went and test drove a car. We took it for a test drive near Beckley, West Virginia. And at some point, we pulled out in front of a van, and the van hit us in the side, T-boned us, and killed Robert instantly. And I sustained massive internal injuries and a severe brain injury. They said I had a chunk of metal sliced 3 inches into my brain.
Oh.
And so There's a chunk of my life I don't remember.
So you don't remember that day before that happened?
No.
Who was driving the car?
I was.
And which side did the van hit?
The van hit on his side. And I don't remember. This has been told to me. The van hit on his side, and he died. And then somehow or another, the steel got into my head and smashed me. And internally, I had my organs rearranged, my lungs collapsed. You know, started waking up in a hospital bed, not knowing why I was there, and everything was real fuzzy, and I couldn't move my legs too well.
What was your first memory coming out of that? When was the first time you were alert enough to know what was going on?
It took a while because for a time I was in what they called an amnesiatic coma, where the brain injury affected my short-term memory and my motor skills. And so at the time, my short-term memory wasn't working. And so I wouldn't remember something 5 minutes to the next. And they told me that it was shortly after the accident, several of my friends came in to see me. And I guess I don't know what was going on in my mind, but I told them, guys, I think it's time for you to leave. And they put me up in a suite at this rehabilitation center. So those the bedroom, and then there was like a kitchen, separated kitchen in a different room. And so my parents stayed with me the whole time, especially my mom stayed with me the entire time. And so my friends like, okay. So they said, you know, bye or whatever. And so they went out, closed the door, and my dad was out in the kitchen there in the hospital suite. And my dad said, just wait 5 minutes. He won't remember you were here. So they waited 5 minutes and went back in. I was like, hey guys, how's it going?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just couldn't remember anything. So at some point after a month or so, I was able to start putting together that I was in a car accident. I don't remember who. I'm sure they told it to me probably every day, but I don't remember at what point it stuck, and I realized that I was not right physically. I had staples in my head, and like I said, I couldn't walk.
But you had no memory during the accident or being rescued or going to the hospital,
yeah.
None at all.
No, I remember none of that. But I don't remember going to the car a lot. I don't remember picking up Robert to go with me or anything.
Gosh.
But I remember it was, we both liked Pontiac, the automaker Pontiac. We liked the Grand Am. I remember passing by this car lot along Route 19 going to Beckley, where there was a white Grand Am, I think it was like a 97 Grand Am. I just wanted to look at the newer car. And so I guess we went over there and test drove the car. But I don't remember going to the car lot. There's like 2 weeks before that, everything's fuzzy.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to remember, you know, looking back to, you know, 20, 30 years. It's hard to remember exactly what
but even at the time, like they would ask, what do you remember? And like, the only thing I could remember was things that happened weeks before the car accident.
Well, at what point did you comprehend that Robert had died in that accident?
It wasn't that I comprehended it. I remember, so Robert was a computer whiz. And this was just when the internet was starting to catch on. He and I were in an HTML class together in high school. We learned a little bit of coding. He was great at it. He was a year below me. And he was the first person that I knew that got a laptop computer. And I remember being in the hospital and because my other friends were coming, but I hadn't seen Robert. And I remember asking my mom or my dad, hey, can you call Robert and see if he can come up here and bring his laptop? I want to play with his laptop. And I think probably I'd asked several times. And then every day during rehabilitation, I saw several therapists. And I forget what role this one therapist played. And he was the one who said, Caleb Robert is not going to come see you. He said he died in your car accident. And it just, even now, I mean, thinking about that moment, it's just, nothing's ever surprised me so much in my life. I felt so bad. It hit me that my best friend was gone, and I was a person behind the wheel whenever the accident happened, and the accident was my fault. And so, you know, I was close with his family, and
did his family come see you at all?
I don't think they did, but I don't remember. I was in rehabilitation for three, four, 5 months, and I don't remember if they came, but a lot of my memories during that time, I couldn't remember anything.
Right.
It actually took a year or two before my short term memory started working better. It still doesn't work well, but it worked to where I'd be able to remember things like that.
Yeah. Losing a friend in that way affects you for the rest of your life. Not only do you have to process the loss of someone you love, but you also have to deal with the guilt that comes with being the one who drove the car, being the one who survived.
For years, I struggled with the guilt. I remember, you know, there'd be times I cried a lot afterwards. I mean, I remember just a couple years after it took place. I mean, I got married. And I remember times when, you know, maybe I'd be laying in bed and I'd just start crying, just thinking about what happened and how Robert wasn't with us anymore, and what he could have been in his life is one of the biggest things that I still think about. Like I said, he was so smart and had such a affinity for using computers that I think he could have done some wonderful things. I go through my life knowing that he's not here because of me. Before the car accident, I played a lot of sports. Still, I could dunk a basketball, and I was very good with numbers and math. Like I could figure a lot of math and numbers out in my head, like some advanced stuff, and that couldn't do that after the accident.
Well, how long did it take? Did you say you were paralyzed and could not walk right after the accident?
No, I wasn't paralyzed. I mean, I could move my legs, but I couldn't make them function correctly.
Because of the brain injury?
Yes.
Okay.
So I had to relearn how to walk and how to talk. Like my mouth didn't work right either. I had to relearn how to walk and how to talk, how to write my own name and everything again. It was a shock to the system because, you know, being a young person, I thought I was invincible. And mm-hmm. suddenly I'm told shown very graphic manner that I am not invincible. I'm not immortal. And I knew that I was never going to be the same. They had told me that it would take me a year to learn how to walk again. And I would never be able to work a full-time job. And I had all these plans and thoughts and things I wanted to do in my life. And I knew laying in that hospital bed that none of that might not ever happen.
And did that feel like anger or terror or sadness?
Sadness.
Anxiety?
It was more sadness than anything because Robert died. And I thought my life is fairly well over too, because, you know, what can I do? I couldn't walk, couldn't do anything.
This accident has defined Caleb's life. Having metal sliced 3 inches into his brain affected his abilities and in some ways his potential. The doctors told him he wouldn't be able to work a full-time job. The expectation he had had for his future was dashed, and he had no idea what his life would be like.
The writing kind of happened out of boredom. A couple of years after the car accident, I still wasn't able to work a full-time job. I did a little bit of retail, but my uncle owned a hearing aid business in Greenville. And he called me up one day and said, "Hey, my secretary just left." He said, "Could you work for me?" He said, "It's a simple job. All you have to do is answer phones, schedule appointments, and service hearing aids when people bring them in to be serviced." He said, "Other than that, you just sit there and look pretty." It's like, "Yeah, I can try this." And so I went to work for him. And there was a lot of downtime. So when there was nobody around, I read a lot of books. The first couple months of working, I read more books those first couple months of working for him than I ever had at any set period in my life. And it got to a point where I thought, well, this is my uncle. I can make my own rules. So I started reading in front of the clients, and he did not like that. So there was one day I'm up at the desk reading a book. There's nobody in the office, and he comes out of his office in the back and says, "Caleb, you can't read books anymore. Doesn't look good for me or my business if you're in here reading books all the time." So there's a computer on your desk. I don't care what you do. Just look busy. And he stalked off. The problem with that computer was this was 2003, 2004. He did not have internet on that computer. The computer had three programs: his scheduling software, Microsoft Paint, and Microsoft Word. And so there's only so many pictures I can draw before I get bored. And so I remember that my English teachers in high school tried to get me to go to college to maybe get a degree in journalism, just because they saw I could put together stories and put together an outline and make sense of words. And so I started writing short stories based on kids that I grew up with in Mount Lookout. After I wrote several of these short stories, I realized they kind of went together. And then maybe if I threw in a character and moved in from out of town, which is something that never happened where the book was set, that maybe, and he stirs up problems for the main character and his friends, maybe I'd be onto something, onto a book. So I did that. And so through the course of working in his lobby over the next year or so, I wrote a book. I had no intention of doing anything with it. Just, it was something I just did out of sheer boredom. But my friends and family knew I was writing a book. And so when I finished it, they said, "Can we read it?" And so I said, "Sure." So I give them a floppy disk with the book on it. Mm-hmm. That's what we had at the time. Some people even paid me to go to Kinko's, FedEx Kinko's, and print off a big stack of printout of it. And so a couple of people read it, and they said, "It's actually pretty good. Have you thought about getting it published?" And it's like, no, not that. At that point, it was like, no, I never thought about it. So I went to the bookstore, got a big thing called big phone book size book called the Writer's Market, which mm-hmm. lists different publishers and agents you could submit your publications to. And so I found a couple that published that type of book, and I sent off query letters and envelopes containing like the first three chapters in it to 10 different publishers and agents, and two of them came back with offers to publish the book. One of them was an outright scammer. Their offer was for me to pay them $3,000 to do it, which, no, I'm just a poor boy living in an apartment with my wife. I can't do that. Another company came back and said, "Yeah, we'd love to publish your book. And we want to offer you a $1 advance on your royalties to sign a contract. We'll publish your book for you." And I said, "Sure." So I signed the thing, sent it back to them.
For a $1
advance. And a couple of weeks later, they sent me a packet, a welcome packet, with a literal $1 bill in the packet. And that $1 bill is hanging in a frame in my office at home.
Caleb found his passion. He wanted to be a writer. His wife worked full-time as a hairstylist, and Caleb became a stay-at-home father and writer while working as a social media marketer.
So when we moved here, our son was at an age where he stopped wanting to take naps in his crib. And so he needed his afternoon naps, and I needed his afternoon naps to maintain my sanity. So I'd put him in the car. We'd drive up and down Ocean Boulevard every day so he would sleep. And it was during one of these trips that I had the idea for this mystery series set in Myrtle Beach, where if you pay attention to the way mystery books and series and just like even on TV are structured, they usually take place in small towns. And Myrtle Beach is by no means a small town because there's the millions of people who come here every week, every summer. But I thought for the people who live and work here, you know, like along the boardwalk, they remain static. So they might see each other, get to know each other. Relationships might develop, gossip lines might open up, whatever. And I thought, what if I can set a series set in Myrtle Beach? Let's make it something fun, because we watched a lot of like BBC mysteries, a show called Monk that was on the USA Network, Psych. We like that type of kind of humorous type show. And I thought, what if I can write this? I'll make a series set here, Myrtle Beach, make it along those lines, something clean, something accessible to everybody, something that casts Myrtle Beach in a positive light. Let's make it appeal to people who not only live here, but people who travel here, mm-hmm. where they can take a piece of Myrtle Beach home with them, or be able to sit somewhere far away like Minnesota during a cold winter, but read about a book set in Myrtle Beach where they can see real places mm-hmm. and people and businesses and restaurants. And so I went home, did some market research because I was doing social media marketing. So I was also familiar with the Facebook ads platform. And I was able to figure out that there was 36 million people who were interested in both Myrtle Beach and mystery novels. So I thought, well, let's develop this character. And I pitched the idea to my publisher. And they loved the idea. They actually told me to stop working on what I was working on then. I still have a partially completed novel somewhere in the cloud.
Yeah.
They said, do this instead. So I wrote the first book, Death on the Boardwalk, and let my beta readers read it. They loved the book. They had a few suggestions on how to change it. And then I sent it to my publisher. They loved the book and sent out a press release to the local media here that there's going to be a book published set in Myrtle Beach February 2nd, 2021. So within a couple of days, I was being contacted by TV stations and newspapers and YouTube channels to do interviews for it. And the hype started building for the book after I was on TV a couple of times, which was really strange coming from where I'd come from. And when the book came out, I'd published four novels before Death on the Boardwalk came out. The day that book came out, Death on the Boardwalk came out, it outsold my previous four books collectively in their entire history in one day. I looked at my wife and I said, if this is going well enough, when our son starts school in 2 years, I want this to be my job. I love telling these stories. I love making this stuff up and keeping people guessing, because it challenges me and my brain to do this. So I said, whenever our son starts school, I want this to be my job. So, well, if you're making enough money doing it, yeah. So the week before our son started kindergarten last fall, no, in the fall of 2022, I'd published the third book in the series. And when that book came out the week before he started school, I was able to start paying all of our bills.
Oh, nice.
And so it's like, all right, this is my job. He's starting school. I have all this time back. Let's push forward with this. And the series has grown, and people love the series. They want to know what happened to Clark's wife. And right now I'm in the process of writing that right now.
And I can tell by your face and by your eyes how much you love it.
Yeah.
That's really great.
Yeah, so this is something I never, ever thought, especially laying in a hospital bed 24 years ago, that this would be something I'd be able to do.
They say write what you know, and though Caleb has never been mixed up in the kind of mysteries he writes, there are elements of his books that come from himself and his past experiences.
There's one book where I did pull from the past. The Search for the Fountain of Youth was an action-adventure novel I wrote several years ago. That one I pulled from my past because my close friends that I had whenever I was in high school, I wanted to get them back together in this book, because and I wanted Robert to be in the book. And I had another friend, Sonny Jack, who died of an epileptic seizure whenever he was in his 20s.
Oh, wow.
So the third friend of our group, Grant, was still alive, and I reached out to him. I said, "Hey, Grant, I'm gonna get the gang back together in this book. Here's what we're gonna do: I'm gonna put you all in like a secret government organization." And he said, "Yeah, put me in it. You can kill me too. I don't care. Just have fun with it." So I wrote the book, and I wrote a scene where Grant died in a helicopter accident, and I finished the book on a Sunday afternoon. It was in July. When I finished the book, a couple hours later, my brother called me, and he's in tears. He said, "Grant died of a heart attack today."
How old was he?
He was 34, I think.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a massive heart attack and died. The day I finished a book where he died in it. So I went back and changed that scene and let him live on. Him and my other friends who had all passed away, they all lived on.
So these are all friends from your core group?
Yes.
Growing up?
Yes.
And so many of them died so young. That's, how do you process that?
It makes me grateful to be alive.
Yeah.
For one thing. And it saddens me for their families, because Grant in particular was old enough to, he had a couple kids that he left behind.
They were probably young too.
Yeah, they were young. So young. Yeah. And so it makes me grateful and thankful for the times that we had together, and grateful, you know, to wake up every morning.
Caleb learned too much about death at a young age, but that struggle led to some powerful personal lessons.
For me, it's being the best person, father, husband, that I can be, and knowing that when I leave this place, when I leave this earth, that something of me gets passed on, whether it be, you know, the way that people looked at me, thought about me. Like I think about my grandpa who just passed away almost 2 years ago. It's like he left a lasting impression on me that I'll remember for the rest of my life. And I hope that I can do that for others, and through my storytelling and being able to leave people with moments of joy and happiness and laughter and intrigue as well. People will tell you it's all going to be okay when you know it's not going to be. And how you approach every day, if you approach every day with a positive attitude that something good's going to happen, even if you feel like it's going to be a bad day, just approach every day like something good's going to happen to me today, or I'm going to do something good for somebody else. Even if nothing good happens to you, do something good for somebody else. Affect somebody else's life. If you're not going to have a good day, make somebody else's day good.
The pain and guilt that came with Robert's death will never fully leave Caleb, but he's determined to leave behind a positive legacy. He was the one to live, so he's going to do something good with the time he has. If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.
We don't just get away at the beach, we get together. Because no matter what floats your boat, we're floating right along with you. With over 2,000 restaurants, live music all day and night, and endless attractions, Myrtle Beach was made for having fun and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 miles where you belong, the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.